Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's Midday Magazine for Tuesday, the 23rd of August, 2016. I'm Joe Vicknicky with the local news. An employee with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game from Petersburg was treated for a shotgun wound last week following an incident on the Stikine River involving another department employee. 43-year-old Chris Ford was treated for only minor injuries and released from Petersburg Medical Center Wednesday, August 17th. According to an investigation by the Alaska State Troopers, Ford and two other Fish and Game employees were working on the Stikine River near Wrangell. Troopers say Ford was injured when his co-worker's shotgun unexpectedly discharged. No foul play is suspected, but troopers say that investigation is ongoing. The condition of an Alaska wilderness guide who was mauled by a bear last week has improved. Authorities say Anna Powers of Hawaii has been hospitalized since she and another guide, Michael Justa of Juneau, were attacked by a brown bear last Thursday as they were leading cruise ship passengers on a hike in the Tongass National Forest in southeast. The Coast Guard rescued the guides and transported them to Sitka, where Justa was treated and released. Powers was then flown to Seattle, where she was hospitalized in intensive care. Hospital now says Powers is in satisfactory condition. Southeast Alaska's regional tribal government is temporarily ending programs that provide food, clothing, and shelter to its most needy clients. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska says federal budget cuts are to blame. Central Council Chief Operating Officer Corrine Garza estimates the programs help about 1,000 tribal members a year. She says those clients are not eligible for other assistance.
Most people don't have any income at all. They don't have any unemployment. They don't have any SSI or Social Security or any other form of income coming in.
The reductions are to the Bureau of Indian Affairs 477 programs, which include general and employment assistance. One cut ends for now, back-to-school clothing vouchers. Garza says the cuts total 20% of the program's $2.6 million annual budget, but the council only learned about it 8 months into the year.
If we knew about it at the beginning of the year, of course you can make cuts throughout the year rather than trying to do it all in a period of 4 months.
Garza says the council received no formal notice of the reduction. She says she found the information in a grant document and confirmed it with the BIA. The federal agency did not immediately respond to emails about the cuts. Tlingit Haida Central Council runs the programs in Craig, Kluwak, Kasan, and Saxman, as well as Wrangell, Juneau, and Haines. It's run by local tribal governments in some communities. Council officials say they're referring clients to other resources when possible. Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization says this month's meetings with the U.S. State Department and Environmental Protection Agency were productive. Among other things, the agencies could help expand water monitoring efforts along the transboundary rivers, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The 30,000-member Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska set up the government-to-government meetings. President Richard Peterson says representatives heard about potential and existing pollution from British Columbia mines near rivers that flow into Alaska.
I think we gave them some of our concerns and questions and whatnot. That gives them the chance to kind of go back and now have that next conversation that's a little more action-based and promissory in nature.
The federal officials met with tribal government and Native corporation leaders from Juneau, Ketchikan, Saxman, Douglas, and Kasan during the August 9th through 11th meetings. Peterson says they talked about water quality monitoring along fish and wildlife-rich transboundary rivers. He says the federal officials expressed interest in supporting the effort.
And we were able to use that as an opportunity to push for more funding for activities region-wide, so that other communities can do that baseline analysis that needs to take place.
State Department and EPA public affairs staff offered no comment on the meetings or any commitments made. That's common for federal agencies. But Peterson says they agreed to hold further meetings, which will happen this fall in Washington, D.C. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott and other state officials presented their concerns at the meetings. He says they brought up a U.S.-Canada Boundary Waters Treaty that includes a commission tasked with resolving such conflicts.
We emphasize that if, when, how, in what manner that the IJC, the International Joint Commission, might be engaged, that we would be, number one, welcome it, number two, be part of it to the degree that that was appropriate.
Malott heads up a state task force on transboundary mine concerns. He says his team also brought up the need for more federal support.
To put it mildly, Alaska is resource constrained, at least fiscal resource constrained right now. And these collaborations and network building is very important.
Alaska and British Columbia officials have been discussing the state's concerns for more than a year. A statement of cooperation detailing ways Alaska can provide more input into mine decisions is nearing a final draft. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Petersburg's Purple Librarian passed away this summer at the age of 100. Ruth Sandvik was well known throughout the community for her work as a librarian and here at KFSK. Here's a remembrance submitted this month by her family. Ruth W. Sandvik passed away July 29th in Seattle's Klein Galland home in the comfort of her family. Ruth, 100 years old, fractured her hip at her assisted living in Petersburg, then was air evacuated to Swedish Medical Center in Seattle. After a successful operation, she suffered a stroke and didn't ever fully recover. Ruth was born in Portland, Oregon, to Herman and Vesta Wedderborg in 1916. Her parents preceded her in death, as well as her sister Betty. She and Betty attended Portland schools. Then Ruth received a liberal arts degree from Reed College. She taught 1 year in Hood River, Oregon, then, disenchanted with teaching, went to work at the local telephone company. A friend from Portland, Alice Foster Longworth, called from Alaska, telling her the local superintendent had a last-minute opening and was offering her a job teaching junior high. In 1941, Ruth headed north on a steamer for what would be a long run. She taught school until son Neil was born and returned as a high school librarian in 1966. She married a local fisherman, Oscar Sandvik, in 1943. Their other children, Mark and Diane, followed in 1948 and 1956, respectively. Oscar preceded her in death in 1969. Ruth was a seasoned sailor, helping Oscar on many trips to Seattle and back on his halibut boat, the Monroe. Ruth was involved in many activities and organizations in her long tenure in Petersburg. She began watching for Japanese warplanes atop the gymnasium during World War II and went on to help found KFSK in that building and perform decades of public service in many spheres, including the Civic Improvement Committee, the Arts Council, the Garden Club, the Museum, the VFW Auxiliary, party politics, scouting, and boards and commissions of all descriptions. Ruth filled her retirement with travel, gardening, and her family. She lived at her home on 2nd Street for 70 years. She moved to Mountain View Manor Assisted Living in 2011 until her death. At Ruth's request, people can send any donations to KFSK. Memorial services will be held in Petersburg September 24th at 2 p.m. in the Lutheran Church. In lieu of flowers, remembrances can be made to KFSK. And we have a correction to a story we aired last week on the Southeast Alaska pink salmon season. Comments from the fishing vessel Relentless should have been attributed to Chris McFadden, not his father, Jeff. In other news, the Juneau Assembly has passed an ordinance that makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Juneau Empire reports that on Monday, the Assembly voted 8-1 to pass that city's first anti-discrimination ordinance, which will protect residents from discrimination when seeking housing or employment. Federal and state law prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, age, religion, and other factors, but do not include protections for gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender people. Before the vote, public comment was overwhelmingly in support of that measure, though a few people said the ordinance was imposing minority values on the majority. One assembly member, Jerry Inank Kervis, voted against the measure. He said he didn't disagree with the sentiment, but the implementation of that new law. He said he had some issues with small parts of the ordinance. Wrangell has been reinventing itself as a maritime community since the collapse of the timber industry in the early 1990s. In November of 2006, the community's Marine Service Center lifted its first boat out of the water. Now, 10 years later, more than 2,000 boats have been hauled out. As Aaron Bolton reports, Wrangell's Boatyard keeps piling on the reasons for its success.
The 112-foot Amber Ann is being hauled out for repairs in Wrangell's Marine Service Center. The owner of the fish tender, Hans Hansen, says the town is home port.
There's a guy who's got a boat called the Gray Sea. His name is Clay. I call him the mayor of Wrangell. He's the one that got me here when they first built the harbor. He said, get your boat over there.
Hansen lives and operates out of Sitka, about 109 miles away. That may seem like quite the distance, but Wrangell's Boatyard is saving him about a 1,400-mile round trip to Seattle. This is the second time Hansen hauled out the Ann in Wrangell. The first time was 2 years ago when he first bought the boat. Now he's back due to a broken rudder shaft.
2 weeks. 2 weeks. I'll be okay. If I'm back in the water by the 1st of September or the first week of September, I'll be a happy guy.
Hansen and his crew plan to do most of the work themselves. But he's also chosen Wrangell because of the work he won't be able to do.
There's a guy here, Tyler. Guy's super awesome. He's a machinist extraordinaire. He'll do all the machine work that needs to get the shaft back in. It's going to be pretty relaxed after we get up and get all situated.
Harbor Master Greg Meisner says that's been the key. Work on what you can for a reasonable haul-out price and get quality work done on the parts you can't.
We do our best to treat them nice and treat them like give good customer service, but they come here for a purpose, and that is to get the vessel worked on. And Wrangell's fortunate enough to have some very good vendors who do a lot of good work down there.
Meisner was part of a team in 2000 that surveyed other boatyards on the West Coast, trying to find out if Wrangell should build its own.
And talking to folks about what we're interested in doing, and kind of looking at what a boatyard consists of, what we should do, what we shouldn't do, try not to reinvent the wheel, but produce something that was similar to a Port Townsend makeup, but was custom fit for Wrangell.
That custom fit produced 104 jobs by 2012, and more than $3 million in private money was invested. Now, 56 vendors populate the list of services, such as welding, fiberglass work, and refrigeration repairs. The boatyard even attracted the reality show The Yard.
Wrangell, Alaska. Owner Don Sorek is one of the busiest men in southern Alaska, running a shipyard in the heart of the fishing grounds.
But Meisner says attracting more vessels is the goal.
You can see a big fish pack or big 110-foot boat come in. It's not one guy rolling paint on. It could be a half dozen guys doing some pretty extensive projects on there. And that's a good thing. It produces more jobs, hopefully, and I think that's the goal of this whole yard.
The yard expanded its reach to 100-foot boats in 2014 with a 300-ton lift. That lift could be expanded to fit boats wider than the current limit of 26.5 feet, but the yard is too small. The borough is looking to acquire the 98-acre former Wrangell Mill site. Part of that property could someday become a boatyard extension.
Well, it takes a long time to expand. I mean, if you got $17 million almost into this, 7.5-acre boatyard down here, you could imagine a 15-20-acre boatyard out there and what you could eventually spend on it. That doesn't say you shouldn't try to do that. You shouldn't work that way, but it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of money. So maybe over time it happens. I hope it does.
The current yard hauls about 270 boats per year. Meisner says that number is sure to increase as Wrangell builds a reputation for working on larger boats. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Heavy rains are soaking Alaska's already soggy south central region, with Governor Bill Walker declaring a disaster in one place because of a river erosion threatening to flood in an area near homes. Walker issued a verbal disaster declaration yesterday for a 3-mile stretch of the Matanuska River north of Anchorage. The disaster declaration, which triggers state assistance, followed a disaster declaration from the Matanuska Susitna Borough that cites riverbank erosion and high waters. South of Anchorage, a flood advisory is in effect until 4 this afternoon in Seward. National Weather Service meteorologist Matthew Clay says the main area of concern is a stretch of the Resurrection River where a road to a nearby glacier has flooded in the past. Clay says rain is expected in that area through Thursday morning, including in Anchorage. For KFSK News, I'm Joe Vicnicki.